Thank you, Scott, and thanks also to UBS for the opportunity to participate in this conference. Well, not surprisingly, given its importance to the Australian economy, the bank monitors developments in China very closely with a team of economists in both Sydney and also in our Beijing office. The easing in growth of the Chinese economy over the past year or so has two related parts. The economy is slowing as it matures, and this is to be expected. Overlaying that, though, there has been a substantial slowing in the industrial sector, and that's linked in part to earlier excesses in construction. How all of this is going to play out and the effects on the Australian economy are uncertain, let me just briefly highlight a few possibilities. Now, it's natural for the speed of China's economic development to ease and for its nature to evolve. Part of that reflects slower growth of the working age population. Indeed, that is now in decline. Other than increasing the retirement age, there's little that can be done to alter that, at least in the coming years. However, growth continues to be supported by the process of urbanisation. That has further to run. It uses commodities very intensively. And while it does have further to run, it's likely to be at a more gradual pace than what we've seen in the past. Productivity growth, that appears to be slowing as windfall gains from earlier reforms have waned. But there remains a pretty large gap between China's productivity levels and those of advanced economies. That gap could be closed more quickly via additional reforms that would allow for greater role for market forces to allocate productive resources. The authorities have certainly expressed support for such reforms. The authorities would also like to see growth rebalancing from investment towards consumption. I think that's gradually happening. It's also being accompanied by a rise in the share of activity which is accounted for by the services sector as the economy develops, as incomes continue to rise. So while those longer-run changes imply a decline in the growth of investment and the growth of industrial production, both of those have also experienced a noticeable cyclical slowing over the past year or more. As the earlier excesses in residential construction gave rise to a very large stock of unsold housing, house prices have declined, and so too housing construction. Sales and prices have recovered a little bit since the start of this year, but there's little sign as yet of a sustained improvement in construction activity. So that weakness in construction has been accompanied by declines in output across quite a wide range of manufactured products over the year. Steel is one obvious and very relevant example for Australia. I should point out, though, that mining activity in China has also been affected. Indeed, a further decline in the output of unprofitable Chinese mines, that would provide some support to commodity prices and would benefit other producers such as those in Australia. Now, although the weakness in China's property and manufacturing sectors is clearly of concern to commodity exporters such as Australia, there are a number of countervailing forces which are helping to support broader activity in China. First, there's the growth in services that I mentioned. That's been resilient. That should continue to be assisted, including by a shift in demand towards services as incomes rise. Second, growth in consumption, household consumption, that's been stable in recent quarters. That's been aided by the growth of new jobs this year. Of course, such outcomes, they can't be taken for granted. If the industrial weakness is sustained, it might eventually affect household incomes and spending. And third, Chinese policymakers have acted. They've responded to lower growth. They've eased monetary policy. They've approved additional infrastructure projects. They have scope to provide some further support if that's needed. Let me finish then with just two key implications of the slowing in China's growth for Australia. The first, very obviously, the substantial slowing in industrial production has contributed to a further decline in commodity prices over the course of this year. We've detailed the effect of those declines on the economy elsewhere. Let me just add, though, today that commodity prices are still pretty high. So the bank's index of commodity prices has fallen by about 50% or so from its peak. It's still about 80% above levels seen in the early 2000s. Clearly, conditions in the industrial sector in China and Asia more broadly are going to have an important influence on the path of commodity prices over the near term. Beyond that, though, the changing nature that I described of China's development, that implies that the potential for commodity prices to rise from here is somewhat limited. And the second point I'd make is that the shift in demand towards services, towards agricultural products in China and the Asian region generally, that presents new opportunities for Australian exporters. I think, though, that while our comparative advantage in service industries are perhaps less obvious than they are for mineral resources, although that's the case, the rise in demand for services will no doubt come from a large and increasingly wealthier populace, and that'll be to our benefit. So let me finish there. Thank you, Scott.
If there is excess capacity in the industrial and commodity sector, is it possible that commodity prices could go back to 2000 levels and hurt Australia? So, Chris, let me add to that. I guess one of the issues that we think about here is trend growth in Australia has typically been sort of 3.25%. And it was 3.25% before China arrived. We quite comfortably managed that sort of growth rate. If commodity prices go back to those sort of 2000 levels and maybe China has a soft lander, is there still risks there for us? Can we regenerate that sort of 3.25% trend growth over the next decade or so?
Well, there's a lot in there. In terms of commodity prices going back to that sort of level, I think there's so many moving parts that would need to come together to do that. You'd need a very substantial further drop in demand. It's possible, one would imagine. But remember, one of the reasons why commodity prices now are much higher than they had been in those levels, because demand's expanded over many, many years to pretty high levels, we've been exploiting globally higher and higher across deposits. So it costs more. So you'd need a really big retraction in demand to sort of bring us back to those sort of levels. Maybe that's possible. Then you have to ask, what are the really high cost producers of things like iron ore doing? And the very high cost ones are in China, and they would be even further under the water. So that could be a mitigating factor. In terms of the adjustment here that we'd be faced with if we had much lower commodity prices than we do now, you'd need a further fall in the exchange rate, one would imagine. And that would help to sort of rebalance growth towards other sectors. We're already seeing some of that happening now as we see the exchange rate adjusting. Unemployment's still reasonably high here, so we do need a period of growth sort of above potential to soak some of that up. Whether that can be sustained at really high levels, though, that'll come down to the all-important productivity growth. And I don't know that that has much to do with commodities going forward, but it's hard to know where we're going on that, on productivity growth.
Right. Productivity and possibly tax reform are all issues that would contribute to us regaining sort of 3 to 3.25%.
Yeah, one would imagine you need it would be as aided by sensible, well thought out reforms.
So if we take it a little bit broader, Chris, if I can ask you, obviously China, with China gearing up over the last 15 years and growing so much more rapidly, the rest of Asia, particularly East Asia, sort of been feeding into that China story. How is the bank viewing the implications for both East Asia in terms of their outlook as China slows, and then bringing that back to Australia in terms of, last time I looked, 75% of our exports went to the broader emerging market sort of complex, a lot of which is in that Asian region. What are the implications of that for Australia?
Well, I think what we've seen over the course of this year, in addition to the easing in growth in China, we have seen a slowing in growth in East Asia generally. Now, that's been that slowing in China has been associated with a reduction in trade and industrial production growth right across the region. I'm not sure that China's the sole source of that weakness. Japanese trade has also been weak. Japanese demand has been reasonably soft over the course of this year. The other thing that's, you know, confusing the picture is that, you know, some of our Asian partners are commodity producers, and much of the reduction in trade across the Asian region reflects lower commodity prices. But clearly East Asia's been affected, their external demand's been weak, and there's signs that that's having some impact on their domestic conditions. The thing, though, I mean, it's such a complicated picture because there is quite a bit of variation across the region. Taiwan's been very heavily affected because of their trade links, no doubt, with China, one imagines. Korea, it's had a little bit of its own sort of snafu with the MERS outbreak earlier in the year. And its growth's picked up in the latest sort of readings. And then, as I said, many of the other economies, which are substantial trade partners, are still developing economies. They've still got very strong growth, and that's likely to continue. So although we're seeing slower growth right across the region, I think, one, we've already seen the effect of that on commodity prices through the course of this year. In fact, maybe commodity prices were providing the earlier signal that then the hard data that was starting to come in from things like GDP and trade and so on were catching up to. And you could see that in base metals prices. Had sort of come off through the year. They've stabilised a bit of late. I think for us, the point is there's still a lot of development opportunities right across the region, including in China. It's still got pretty strong growth. And we've got to remember it's, you know, it's nearly twice the economy it used to be sort of 10-plus years or so ago. And its growth rate hasn't halved, so it's still making a substantial contribution. The same is true of East Asia. It's still got very strong growth. India's probably worth a mention. It's growing as a trade partner, and its growth has held up and been pretty strong. You know, so we've got this near-term softness, but the longer-term, you know, prognosis, one imagines, is quite a good one, and it's fortuitous for us that we're linked into that region.
One of the questions that's come through here is, what are types of indicators or business liaison are the RBA staff in Beijing sort of looking at? What sort of information?
Well, I mean, they do. They obviously talk a lot to the various authorities in Beijing and travel a lot around the country as much as they can. I mean, I think what they're doing is just helping us get a feeling on the ground from researchers, other financial institutions that are based there, are close links to the authorities. So they facilitate visits from senior staff from head office going there. I mean, there's no one particular series or set of series. They gather as much information as they can. And, you know, we've also got staff in Sydney and who are monitoring these things. And a key benefit is amongst some of those staff is to have key language skills so you can read stuff that's not available on a timely basis and really understand the data that is available.
So one of the first question I wrote down when I was thinking about this panel was systemic risks. We've talked a lot about China slowing down, and even though, you know, we've got numbers with five high fives on it by 2017, we're sort of putting that in the framework of a soft landing. I'll ask all of you, and Chris, you can defer if you wish. But what are the systemic? Why isn't there a systemic problem there? What are the risks in the shadow banking system, in the banking system, in broader the equity market? Why can't we have a systemic event in China?
Do you want me to try and start?
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible to have a more substantial slowing in China that comes in potentially through the financial system problems that they might experience, given they've got high levels of debt. That's something we've mentioned in our recent statement. It's the sort of thing we've been mentioning actually in our statements when discussing uncertainties for some time. One of the things we mentioned recently was the fact that the weakness in the industrial sector is affecting some parts of the country more than others. Those parts of the country are often close also to the parts of the country that are experiencing stress in the mining sectors. So one imagines it's possible that if that weakness continues, perhaps a smaller financial institution that has a lot of exposure there might run into trouble. And then I think the really big question in China, and the other panellists may have different views, but the really big question, I think, is, well, what do the authorities do in response to that? Do they see it in a timely manner? And how do they react? And there's a question between the sort of the regional authorities versus the central authorities. And all of the power to do a lot is obviously at the centre. So, look, they've got a lot of options. They've still got a lot of fiscal space to respond if needed. And I think that's the big question if some event was triggering financial stress somewhere.